Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
If you've ever been anywhere near a lake in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, you've probably heard this. But what do you do when you hear this? We'll learn about all things loon from an expert. Plus,
everybody wants some loving.
He's one of the most prolific producers in the Twin Ports. Now, he's moving on.
It's a constant journey that sometimes needs a mental break.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
I'm on my way now, come around.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Everybody wants some loving.
He's one of the most prolific producers in the Twin Ports.
It's a constant journey that sometimes needs a mental break.
Now, he's moving on. But first, if you've ever been anywhere near a lake in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, you've probably heard this. But what do you do when you hear this? We'll learn about all things loon from an expert. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We all know that familiar cry of a very familiar bird, or maybe we think we know it. How much do we really know about the common loon? And before you answer, what could they possibly have to do with penguins? Well, someone who knows the answer to those questions and more is James Perook. He teaches biology at St. Joseph's College and the University of Southern Maine and grew up in Detroit. But he got his first look at loons right here on Lake Superior. Now he's written a book, Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. And he joined my WPR colleague, J. Carlisle Larson, to talk about them. Here's their conversation.
James, welcome so much to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been studying loons for about 30 years now. Do you understand the appeal and the mystique of the loon and why they're so captivating to people?
Absolutely. They're one of the few mega charismatic species of birds that touch all of us. And I think part of it is their vocalizations. You know, you played at the beginning. You know, those haunting calls, I think, strike a chord with us in terms of our emotions. I think we have primal vocal centers. And, you know, you play like an E minor or D minor chord on a guitar or piano, and it touches us. It hits our heartstrings. And I think with the calls that you played for the loons, I think they do that. And secondarily, I would say the fact that you can easily identify a loon on a lake, it's black and white, it's unmistakable. And then the fact that they raise a family, those of us who have children can relate to the arduous task of raising young. I think those characteristics of loons make them romanticized, as you described in the beginning.
Yeah, I really like what you were talking about with the call and how it kind of tugs at the heartstrings. The first time I heard a loon, I was camping far up north in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and it was maybe at dawn. It woke me up, but then as soon as it kept crying, I was really moved by the sound of it. You know, that's just my story, but how did you get interested in studying loons?
Yeah, and that was very fortunate, too. So my upbringing, I grew up in inner city Detroit, so very urban environment, Wayne County, Michigan, 20,000 people per square mile, I think, in terms of density. My parents didn't hike, camp, or fish. Lovely parents, gave me a great upbringing, childhood, but I just never got exposed to the natural world. And Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom was a show I saw on Sunday nights on TV, and it planted a seed in my mind about being a biologist. And I went camping on Isle Royale National Park there in Lake Superior, and I heard and saw my loons for the first time when I was roughly a high school senior. And that really touched me. kind of emotionally. Here's a bird I didn't even know existed, for example, and here they were on the lake. So pretty similar to what you described. And then in a nutshell, to kind of keep things moving along, in college I met a buddy who was attending the same university as I was in Michigan, and he ended up figuring out how to catch loons for his master's degree. His name was Dave Evers. And as a buddy, I went to try to help him catch loons. And when I caught my first loon, I think this was in 1989, you can just imagine putting a loon on your lap, what that's like, the powerful experience that was. And that really got me thinking about studying loons for a career.
Now, Jim, let's get down into kind of the nitty-gritty of loon evolution. What do we know about the bird's ancestors?
Yeah, a lot of what we're trying to do is to determine that today is rather than just look at external anatomy, just bones, for example. You know, we can look at the cellular level, extract DNA, and look at similarities of DNA among different birds, for example. And that's really probably the best tool we have to understand the nearest neighbors in terms of loons, for example. So I mentioned in the book, it looks like penguins, as of now, are the closest ancestors to loons. And they shared a common ancestor possibly 50 to 55 million years ago. And loons that we know today seem to be about 2.5 million years ago in terms of the fossil record matching up bones with modern skeletons today. So we know they kind of have a long evolutionary history. And the modern ones we see today seem to be fairly current within the last 2.5-3 million years.
Their closest likely relative is a penguin. That might be a surprise for people who, you know, might be familiar with seeing a loon, but also seeing a duck, just as an example. So these two birds are not related at all.
Yes, correct. And it was interesting. We used to think maybe ducks or grebes, mergansers, may have been closest relatives. And the DNA is telling us otherwise. It's suggesting penguins are probably the nearest relatives. And it's interesting, too, because loons are mostly the northern hemisphere and penguins are the southern hemisphere.
You know, one thing, as I was getting ready to talk to you, I watched a video of a loon walk on land. So they're very elegant on the water, but not so much on the land. Can you talk a little bit about, just sticking with that evolution, why they're maybe a little bit more suited for the water versus, you know, dry land?
Sure. One can look at it in terms of a trade-off, for example. And now that the Olympics is coming up, we think about swimming and running events. And those that are for endurance versus sprinting, you know, have a different anatomy in terms of muscles and length, for example. And so using that analogy, if it's helpful, here we see a bird that's extremely specialized for swimming underwater. And there's very few underwater diving birds. So in contrast to a duck like a mallard that might tip and be buoyant, deep diving birds have to have adaptations that allow them to move through the water efficiently. And so their whole anatomy is streamlined. And because they use their legs to propel themselves versus their wings, for example, like a penguin, you know, the legs are far back, large webs to help propel and generate thrust to push the loon, you know, through the water to catch fish. So everything about the loon is streamlined. Think about another analogy as a torpedo, just in terms of its sleekness, aerodynamic. In this case, it would be hydrodynamic, to be extremely smooth, not to have any crests, any bones that are sticking out. So you want the hips to be narrow, the shoulders to be narrow, for example. And if I can just share just another ecological trade-off.
Of course.
Sure. If let's say I have a big keel, and most of us have turkey and chicken, we're familiar with the breast muscle of those birds and the large keel. Well, if a loon had a large keel, that would slow it down swimming underwater. So by having a breast that's very thin, for example, that doesn't have muscle attachment sites, it allows it to move through the water more efficiently. However, the trade-off now is I don't have enough place for large muscle attachments from my chest to propel me to get off the ground. So that's why loons have such long runways, because they've kind of sacrificed, for example, the ability to dive, to have smaller chest muscles and a smaller place of attachment. And consequently, right, it's much difficult for them to get to obtain lift versus a bird like a mallard, for example.
We are talking to Jim Peruk right now. He has been studying loons for almost 30 years, and he teaches biology at St. Joseph's College and the University of Southern Maine. What is the parenting process like? Are there gender roles at all?
Yeah, and what we've kind of learned is that loons do not mate for life. So that was popularized on Golden Pond, you know, decades ago. And because of banding efforts by a number of researchers, where you put colored leg bands on their feet, you can follow individuals through time. And so we know that pairs may stay together. They're serially monogamous for maybe 5 to 15 years, for example. But eventually there's going to be a pair turnover and a new mate. There'll be a mate switch, for example. And in terms of parental responsibilities, I was investigating that in the 90s and wondering if it was closer to 50-50 in terms of parental relationships and roles. And I pretty much concluded it was close to a 50-50 partnership. And I think it's an analogy, and it's not always good, I realize, to stretch analogies to humans, but we are humans and we can relate to that. But it's kind of looking at raising children today, like both parents are responsible and needed in order to raise children oftentimes because of the tremendous effort involved. It certainly makes life easier. So you see a coordination between pair members. And I think that's what you find, or as you mentioned, Jay Carlisle, is that there seems to be a kind of a partnership that evolves and develops between pairs. And pairs that are more refined and more in tune to each other probably are more successful in raising more loon chicks.
I want to shift a little bit to other loon behavior. We have heard a little bit of their song. And, you know, as you write in the book, loons have a few vocalizations that can be heard from about 600 feet away or more. There are wails, yodels, tremolos. Let's hear a wail first. And this is courtesy of the Loon Preservation Committee in New Hampshire. So we've heard the wail a few times, but what is a loon communicating with that song?
Yeah, and it's interesting for all the listeners there, we noticed a changed frequency, right? So there was a change in frequency, so almost like a two-note wail. And that is kind of a contact call. It's a bird that's concerned, right? So maybe there's a boat moving into a territory, for example, and so it might try to contact its partner, for example, the other pair member, and might try to get its attention that something's going on around the nest or in our area. So, for example, if they had chicks. And usually what happens is the other pair member comes closer to the originator of that call and may respond as well. And you might have a little back and forth with those whale calls.
Now, we mentioned also a tremolo. Let's take a listen to that really quickly. So it's like this quick burst of notes. What is the purpose of the tremolo?
Yeah, and so when we hear the tremolo, for example, those kind of laughing calls that we might have heard, it's really an alarm call. It's a more threatening situation. So if the canoeist, kayaker, or boater gets too close, their space feels threatened. And so now the anxiety is heightened. So they move from a wail to a tremolo. And that's communicating to its other pair member, which will usually tremolo back in response. The pair will get closer together. And so a tremolo is, for example, if you hear one, it's possible that you might even be the cause of the, for example, the stress or the anxiety that the bird is experiencing.
And really quickly in that vein, if you are worried that you might be causing stress for a loon, what's the best course of action if you want to be respectful of their space?
Sure. And the best thing is probably to move out of that area, for example, you know, slowly just kayak or canoe away for leaving the loons alone, giving them kind of some kind of threshold, some space, some invisible line where they feel safe. And usually if you move far enough away, you'll notice the calls we'll essentially quit, for example.
Now let's listen to the final vocalization. We have a yodel. So what is that yodel communicating?
So that yodel in this case is only given by male loons. And it seems like it's more of like announcing, here's my territory. I'm willing to defend it. it's not so much to attract mates. For example, like some birds like cardinals and blue jays or robins in our backyard are singing to attract a mate, for example. But common loons, so that when the male gives that yodel call, it's not so much to attract females as it really is to announce the fact that I'm here, this lake is occupied, I'm willing to defend it, for example. And you can tell, like anyone who's seen loons yodel, it's very explosive, lots of energy in terms of producing the call. They'll often spin in a circle and broadcast that vocalization around the lake. And sometimes on a clear night, those vocalizations can carry 5 to 10 miles.
Oh, wow. That's really far for a bird call. And it feels like an effective way of communicating with others to other males, maybe to back off a little bit. So some loon terminology. What are baby loons called? What group are they a part of, and more?
Yeah, real briefly. So loons predominantly will lay 2 eggs. And in the book, I talk about some biologists have theorized that the 2-egg clutch seems to be optimal for loons, that most birds do not lay just 1 egg in case one's infertile. So they're almost always going to go through the effort of laying 2 eggs. And then 3 eggs might put too much pressure on the loon family in terms of the adults to feed them. So the young might actually, you might be able to hatch 3, but they might be poorer condition, have less survival. So 2 eggs seems to be about the optimal clutch size. I'm not aware of any, like, you know, you might hear loonlets, for example, but, you know, as biologists, we've always called them chicks, for example. And in terms of mostly we've always just used the terminology for groups or flocks of loons, for example. And hopefully that helps out the answer to those questions.
We are talking to Jim Peruk right now. He's the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver, and he has been studying loons for nearly 3 decades. You know, part of studying loons, it's certainly gotten much more advanced since maybe the Audubon days. How do you go about tracking loons in, 2021?
Yeah, and I think what we've learned is that radio transmitters work fairly well. So that's a technique that's been used in wildlife management. But that works for small-scale movements, but for large-scale movements. So, for example, to follow loons that hatch in Wisconsin, ultimately to determine where they winter, so kind of connecting the migratory pathway between breeding and wintering, you know, we would use satellite telemetry. And so that's become more sophisticated. And now you essentially, like, I would hire like a wildlife vet, for example, to conduct the surgeries. They would implant the satellite transmitter, the little antenna would stick out from the loon, and then the satellites orbiting the Earth would pick up that signal, and then we could plot those locations on an Earth, for example, and we'd be able to kind of get locations of those individuals.
Have you found any sort of surprising new information from tracking loons this way?
Well, one thing that I was off the coast of Louisiana, and we put 2 satellite transmitters in loons in the Gulf of Mexico, and these individuals flew all the way to northwest Saskatchewan, so over 2,700 miles. That's the longest distance migrant that we know of loons. So imagine flying that far. Northwest Saskatchewan is actually closer to the Pacific coast. Mm-hmm. So you wonder if some loons there go to the Pacific coast.
Really quickly, as we wrap up, what mystery is still there about the loons? What are you all trying to still, tease out about loons?
Well, the one thing that's missing, right, is physiological studies. We've been able to do physiological studies on penguins. You can kind of put some equipment inside of a penguin and be reasonably assured you're going to be able to re-catch it. With loons in the breeding grounds, it's really hard to re-catch a loon once it's been caught once within, let's say, a day or two or a week. So if we're trying to look at, like, how does climate change impact loons, we really need to know what the physiological limits to loons are in terms of upper temperatures and lower temperatures, whether they feel comfortable to stress. And so for me, that's probably a big one that we're still trying to learn about. And I also think just in continuing to monitor loons, to kind of link staging to wintering areas, to breeding areas, would be real important. So we may want to identify places where they stage and to try to protect those. And similarly, on the wintering grounds, we may need to want to protect areas there.
Well, Jim, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jay Carlisle.
That was University of Southern Maine biologist James Perruque speaking with WPR's Jay Carlisle Larson about all things loon. Coming up, Daniel Oyinlowe says farewell in the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Daniel Oyinlowe is one of the Twin Ports' most versatile producers, performers, musician, artist, storyteller, poet, and community organizer. And if you heard all that before, it's because we've had him on the show several times before, and I've said this exact same line. But unfortunately for all of us, you'll soon have to remove Twin Ports from his affiliation. He's moving on, along with his wife Sandra and their toddler son Jaleel. And he's here to tell us why and tell us where. Welcome back to Simply Superior, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So before we get to where and why you're leaving, you have yet another show you've produced at Zeitgeist in Duluth. You're not going to leave, I guess, without a splash is what's going on here. We're recording this on Tuesday, and by the time we air today, Friday, it will have happened, I believe. So, and I'm sure you'll have it available online. What's the theme? Who's in it? And what's it all about?
So we decided to do a film screening of three curators. Well, myself being one of the filmmakers, and then Dev Changyara, who is a Twin Cities artist and filmmaker, Jeremy Gardner, who is a Twin Ports area, Cloquet area creative. So we came together and put together a list of films in three different categories, music videos and poetry in one category, short films and behind the scenes in another category, and documentary, artist bio documentaries in a third category. Just compelling to see how all of these stories, in most of which were produced in this region, were sort of laced together and could inspire and continue to inspire the community as a whole.
And where can we see this online, perhaps?
So we were hoping to do online, like live stream viewing for free for everyone across, but we haven't settled on if that's going to happen because that's going to take a little bit of work to package. And I don't know if we'll be able to get that done. So no promises, but we are thinking about that too.
All right. In general, though, is there a URL to find out all things Daniel?
Absolutely. If you want to ever get any information on what we're doing, dansandcreatives.org.
All right. That's dansandcreatives.org. That's dansancreatives.org. And now the big news. You are leaving. Where, when, why? Start with the why.
Well, the why is it's almost spiritual. It's been sort of happening the last year and a half. Our journey in Duluth started since college. You know, I went to college at UMD. My wife also went to college at UMD. After college, we both left. I went back to the cities and ended up coming back to Duluth, worked at UMD, then left to San Francisco, came back, went to Texas, came back. It's sort of been a relationship of like going and coming and going and coming. And I think the last trip here, we invested ourselves in starting the company that we did here because there are lots of creative energy in Duluth that we think need to be continue to be nurtured. We got to keep growing that network connections. My wife finished her master's degree here in Duluth, and she also wants to explore that path. So it was only right for us to also consider leaving the space again. And I think, so in the last year, we've sort of been thinking about what that's going to look like. Where are we going to go? We have a son. We want our son to also grow up in a community with family, and we have some family in the Twin Cities. So we ended up deciding we'll make the move for everyone because it would help everyone in the family continue the work we started and build on that. We all needed it. My son needed it. My wife needed it. I needed it. I think it was important. Plus, Duluth is not often set up in a way where the work we do, all of us, both my wife, myself, there's a limit you could do it here. The infrastructure does not let you go beyond a certain boundary to do that work. And for us to really do it the way we want to do it, I think it's important for us to do it on the network we have beyond Duluth, even beyond the Twin Cities, Chicago, the Midwest region.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just passionate about continuing to build that network and build creative connections and see what sort of platforms we could create together as creators in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. So it isn't necessarily the Twin Cities. That's sort of a jumping off point.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we're not really like, you know, tied down, but we do recognize the importance to be invested. And mm-hmm. and the fact that we live in Duluth also doesn't mean we're leaving Duluth. I'm literally coming back in August. I already have like 4 or 5 trips scheduled back to Duluth. So it's like, so I'm still going to be in Duluth because I care about the space. I have people that I'm working with in the space. So we're invested.
All right. And I'm going to give you some parenting advice that you didn't ask for. But when Jaleel starts entering maybe a preschool and kindergarten, you mm-hmm. might want to find someplace a little bit more permanent.
That's true. I don't want to be that parent that does not let my kid have one steady friend group. We'll see how it goes. You know, if he's making a good connection in the Twin Cities, that may be a reason to stay longer.
All right. I'm wondering if you have any of your music that might mark the occasion.
Oh, absolutely. So I've been, this year I wanted to take more of a musical break so I could do more music management. But I ended up getting pulled back into the music by Charles OBJ. He's an artist who just released a 6-song EP. I think I featured in about 4 of them. And one of the songs is called Good Things. And that's a song that I've been sort of playing over and over for myself. So it's about focusing on the good things to come, the good things that are here. And I really enjoy our collaboration on that.
All right, let's listen to Good Things by Charles OBJ, featuring our guest, Daniel Oyenlowe.
My mind is a world someday, yeah. If I'm not thinking about you, I've been lost in my universe, baby. The monsters come lurking at my door. Insecurities come knocking and knocking. Some call it experience, fear of everything. But I'm loving and I'm hating everything. And then I'm good. I knew I found a good thing. That would give a good thing. When I see you, I see all the good things, yeah. Good things, baby, I see all the good things, yeah. When I hear you, I hear all the good things, yeah. Good things, baby, I hear all the good things, yeah. You are more than a good thing, I see all the good things, yeah. Good things, good things, baby, I see all the good things, yeah. When I hear you say, I have the good things, yeah. Good things, baby. I have the good things, yeah. Oh, yeah. You bring me peace. Even when it's hard outside to leave. Baby, baby. Loving is a good thing. Good thing. You have me there for you and something special like a queen for a good king. Tryna make a little bit more room for my good things, cause yeah, it was blessings to be, yeah. All because of you, baby. When I see you, I see all the good things, yeah. Good things, baby, I see all the good things, yeah. When I hear you, I hear all the good things, yeah. Good things, baby, I hear all the good things, yeah. You are more than a good thing. I see all the good things, yeah. Good things, baby. I see all the good things, yeah. When I hear you say, I have the good things, yeah. Good things, baby. I have the good things, yeah. Oh yeah.
Give me all your love, shallow eye, baby. Don't go far away. You're my only something. Every other girl can stand by far away. You're my sweet potato.
when I hear you. I hear the good things, yeah. Good things, baby. I hear the good things, yeah. You are more than a good thing. I see all the good things, yeah. Good things, good things, baby. I see all the good things, yeah. When I hear you say, I hear the good things, yeah. Good things, good things, baby. I hear the good.
And that was Good Things by Charles Obije, featuring our guest, Daniel Oyelowo. And you're telling us about your leaving town, but then the occasion of your leaving has apparently led to several appointments here. You just told us that you're going to be back in town shortly after you leave. But I sort of sense a mental moving on. Am I correct in that?
No, you're very correct, definitely. It's very needed, at least for me and my family. You know, it's tough. I speak from a place as a man of color, as a black man living in Duluth, in the Twin Ports. It's a constant journey that sometimes needs a mental break. And I think that's part of the joy of moving, is to feel more in a space where you may not feel like you're alone or you're less than, you know, where there's a lot more community around you. In a significant extent, even like think about it, like food. Like I could think about ordering food and I have options of food to order. That alone, I don't have to worry about streamlining the options, you know. And so on the mental base for that, it's definitely something we're looking forward to. I think it's going to be healing for us.
Right. Well, there's no question there's a few more food options in the Twin Cities in Chicago, in any larger city, than there is in Duluth. And you might find something that's a little spicier than the normal Minnesota palate might. Yeah, right. You've experienced right. that, too. But on a serious note of that, you know, you mentioned as a man of color, obviously, Duluth's demographics are, you know, not that diverse, much more than people think, I believe, by the way. But let me ask you this, sort of challenge you on it. It's true that people of color stand out here. There's no question. I'm certainly experienced that myself. On the other hand, it's a small enough community that if there is change needed, or if there's someone you think you can appeal to for the change, you can actually talk to them, you know, in Chicago. And it may be a black female mayor or whatever, but, you know, good luck trying to get an appointment with her, right? But in Duluth, I mean, you bump into Emily about 3 times a day, you know, so you know, how do you reconcile that? On the one hand, yes, there may be more difficulties, you may be more alone. On the other hand, you're closer to the power structure or simply, you know, people who are involved in things.
Yeah, but the depth of that, you know, it's not that simple. I would say I see the part of me being able to bump into Emily or connect or the power structures or know my councilman even much more personally. I see that. But the thing is, even if I had all the opportunity in Duluth to have conversations with the mayor, doesn't mean change is going to happen. It doesn't ever mean they have the power to make that change. Because of the demographics, because of the infrastructure, because of the investment of the unions and all of the families of the unions and how what the priorities of the unions are. And so that's a problem that you find, obviously, in the small town and in the big city. Whether we get closer to change or not, it's hard to say, because in a bigger city, there are certain infrastructures that are already in place because of the advocacy of people. There's been a legacy of advocacy in the power structures. And because of that level of advocacy, more changes actually occurred than in a city where that legacy is still strained and has less power and less momentum and less energy. And that, to me, is a significant difference. So despite the fact that we're connected to power, it does not necessarily bring about change. We're still here without any space. We only have a few restaurants popping up here and there, but it's like, we still don't have space. We still don't have the culture that helps retain folks who want to invest more. I'm talking about Black and brown folks, not talking about folks who want to come to do development work, you know, just strictly development work. What I'm focused on is, where is the change for cultural Duluth, for Black Duluth? Where's the change that we have been advocating for 20 years in Duluth, that we've spoken to not only one administration, two administrations in my time alone here? You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that's still frustrating to me, because it's like, being close to the power structures is not equal change, because change is not just about connecting with power. It's about power understanding that there isn't enough power for the people to even have enough power to advocate for themselves.
Right. And by the way, when we say Duluth, we, of course, mean the Twin Ports, Duluth Superior, surrounding area.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
One more devil's advocate sort of question here. Don't we need you, actually, to help remedy that? Or I certainly understand you have to do what's best for you, your wife, your family. But
I'm not running for any office. I'm not an engineer. Where I come in is I talk to all these folks. I ask questions just like you. I'm sort of a journalist, but also I try to look at things quietly for a while and speak about it the best way I can, or connect with creators that could help amplify it. I'm a storyteller. I'm a person who feels like when we look at our history, the ways that we've advocated for change that we often overlook is also embedded around stories. And I think that's how we begin to advocate for this space, is for folks to understand that need in the space and to speak that truth about the space, so that it's not just covered by, oh, it's a beautiful city, it's great, people here are good, which those are good things. Those are actually true facts, but doesn't necessarily amplify the voices that need to be amplified for structural change to happen. Even if I stayed with my family and I deprived my son of a lot more cultural engagement, and I sacrifice my energy beyond what I can, and I'm not getting paid for the things that I do because the infrastructure here just doesn't allow for it, and they demand more volunteer services.
Right.
I would end up dying.
Which, by the way, is not just affecting people of color. You hear that, we've heard that forever for a lot of people in Duluth.
Right. In context of people of color, though, there's that expectation of us, because this is a problem that has to do with our, like, the uplifting of our people. So you feel an obligation that a white person wouldn't feel. Now, I'll be thinking about taking care of my family, but I'm not only thinking about that. I have to think about, oh, I have to go do this thing with the community, go to the school, and then I have to go to city council to talk to the city council. Then I got to talk to the mayor. And these are things we're still going to do regardless. But the demand becomes so much for every person of color that we don't even get time to just go chill, hang out, build together, relax together, have joy together. That in Duluth is almost like a foreign object thing. Like, even with the friends I've sort of made in the last 3-4 years, we forced ourselves to do that more, to just go to the lake, go outdoors and just hang out, you know, not even talk about change for a second, take a bike ride.
Right.
These are the healing factors that we need, and we need more capacity to have that than to expend all of our energies always bleeding for our community and fighting for justice and still not getting any room because the infrastructure just wouldn't let room for it. So right. I think that's where I come from that space of, like, it's a unique problem to our culture. As much as I can understand we all relate to on a class level to the struggle, but there is a unique, distinct cultural struggle for Black and brown folks in Duluth. A part of my job is to tell that story.
All right. As you tell those stories, give us another one, some song or music that you think is appropriate at this time.
So part of the 6-song EP that Charles OBG released, another song I featured on, is called Blessings. It's about blessings. It's about fighting for something. It's about recognizing the joy that you have in life. It's about thriving in peace. And Yahweh, which I believe is God, that's my faith, is, you know, just a giver of joy.
All right. We've been speaking with Daniel Oyinlowe, one of the creative forces in Duluth, Dance Sands Creatives. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And here is Blessings by Charles OBJ, featuring Daniel Oyinlowe.
Everybody wants some loving. Everybody wants some loving. blessings, yeah. Ooh, yeah. Blessings on blessings on blessings. Emotionless without you, without you, Yahweh. Without you,
we can go away sometime. Fly away, away sometime.
Fly away, away sometime.
Away, away, away sometime.
Fly away, away sometime.
Fly away, away sometime.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Gating. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Brooks, there's a local star done good at the Olympics, local Minnesota, that is, but something everybody in the state could be proud of.
Absolutely. Suni Lee, the first Hmong American to make the U.S. Olympic team, took home the gold medal in the gymnastics all-around individual competition on what was Thursday morning for us here in the U.S., but of course later in the day in Tokyo. You know, Lee was able to take sort of the spotlight as Simone Biles stepped away out of mental health concerns. So, you know, all eyes were on her and, well, just an amazing routine. I really encourage anyone to just look up her gold medal routine. And the gold was the fifth in a row for an American gymnast in the Olympic women's all-arounds. And like the Simone Biles drama added some uncertainty, but Sunisa Lee came out on top.
All right. Well, back home, and also with another fairly local connection, there's some star power coming to join the Line 3 struggle.
Yes. Just this week, it was announced that Bon Iver, the pride of Eau Claire, the singer-songwriter, will be coming to Bayfront Festival Park in Duluth in August for an anti-Line 3 concert. And so he's going to be joined by a number of other acts, and it will go all day. But this is certainly a big name and will be a big draw for folks, not just pipeline opponents, but it's the only concert for the indie rock singer-songwriter so far this year on the books. As far as I know, it's his first time in Duluth, and it's definitely going to be a big draw and a big boost for pipeline opponents.
And did you make up that couplet yourself?
I did, yes. I don't think I've read that anywhere.
All right, we'll give you full credit for Bon Iver, the pride of Eau Claire. Well, speaking of the environment, Minnesota's getting tougher on cars.
Yeah, the clean car standard that California adopted is now on the books in Minnesota. Minnesota is the first Midwestern state to take these stricter tailpipe emission standards and mandate for automakers to get more zero emission vehicles onto sales lots. Governor Tim Walz pushed really hard for the standards as part of his efforts to combat climate change and to get Minnesota on track to meet its own greenhouse gas reduction goals set years ago by lawmakers. So the rules don't take effect for auto dealers until January 1st, 2024, which gives some time for the state and utilities and perhaps this federal infrastructure bill that's moving ahead to set out more charging stations. Minnesota Power out of Duluth is already putting up a few more in the next few years. So that should help adoption, they think, and certainly helps the company's bottom line.
All right. Well, Danny, on the Wisconsin side, and continuing our theme of the environment, the Attorney General was around our area recently to talk about the controversy over the leader of the Natural Resources Board.
Yeah, there's been pressure mounting in recent days on the Democratic Attorney General, Josh Call, to remove the board's chair, Fred Prain, after his 6-year term expired on May 1st. And that's because a couple of groups last week, including the Humane Society and the Center for Biological Diversity, ask call to review Prane's legal status on the board and essentially bring some sort of legal action to remove him before the board's next meeting in August. You know, this has become kind of a political power struggle on the Natural Resources Board after Democratic Governor Tony Evers announced the appointments of Ashland school teacher Sandy Nas and Milwaukee real estate developer Sharon Adams at the end of April. But Prane has refused to step down from his seat. And now more groups are calling to take action on this matter. And he said on Monday that they're going to look at it based on what the law says and that they're not going to let politics play a deciding role in what drives their decisions.
All right. Attorney General Call also weighed in on the ongoing Catholic Church sexual abuse scandal. Yes?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he's been traveling the state and visiting cities where the state's five Catholic dioceses are located. The Wisconsin Department of Justice has been conducting a statewide investigation of sex abuse by clergy at Wisconsin's five dioceses, and that includes the Superior Diocese. And basically, he's been traveling around the state asking people to come forward and report sexual assault that they may have experienced, even if the statute of limitations may have expired. And so far, they've received more than 100 reports of sexual assault or how faith organizations have responded to abuse since launching the investigation in April. But he has noted that not all of the dioceses have been cooperative. In particular, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee has challenged the statewide inquiry, saying that Call's investigation was unreasonably broad and questioning his authority to review it. But they want victims or survivors of abuse to feel safe in coming forward. If they have any reports of abuse, he said that they will be supported in that. And Douglas County District Attorney Mark Fruhoff joined him in that call, saying that they will handle their reports in a safe and confidential manner. And the Superior Diocese told WDIO in a statement that they are cooperating with this investigation at the state level, and that they're not aware of any new reports or allegations against anyone in the diocese.
And lastly, a little on the theme of natural resources, but just maybe doing the right thing. Superior has decided to return burial lands to the Fond du Lac ban.
Yeah, the Superior City Council has shown support for this effort. They voted recently to pass a resolution in support of transferring these lands back to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Wisconsin Point marks the ancestral home of the tribe, and they settled there as early as 400 years ago. But unfortunately, that history is marred by historic injustice. You know, more than a century ago, nearly 200 Ojibwe graves were removed from the burial grounds, and at least seven generations of Fond du Lac members were laid to rest there at the Wisconsin Point Cemetery, including the community's leader, Chief Joseph Osagie. And also living tribal members were uprooted and forced to move off of Wisconsin Point. And now Native families want to see that land return, and the tribe wants to see that land return, as well as a reburial site where those graves were moved to in Superior. And so this Superior City Council has shown support for this. It's something that has been spearheaded by Councillor Jenny Van Sickle. She's been working with the Fond du Lac tribe and their chairman, Kevin Dupuy, on this. And there's still many steps that have yet to be taken. You know, they're going to be working with Democratic Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin to prepare a petition for the Interior Department Secretary Deb Haaland. So basically, they still have to go to the Interior Department to get approval to put these lands in federal trust for the tribe.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Charles OBJ and Daniel Oyelowo. Stay safe, everyone.
I've been waiting.
waiting for a time like this, praying for a day like this, a day like this. I've been waiting to tell my story, to tell my story. I've been waiting, make a shower down. If there's a time like this,